enterprise, it is actually the energy transfer subsidiaries that have been criminally convicted of environmental crimes in August of last year. So there is a bit of irony to what they're alleging.
Deepa Padmanabha, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Deputy General Counsel for Greenpeace USA. A judge has thrown out the $100 million slap suit that the Canadian logging company waged against Greenpeace USA. That does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Dennis Moynihan, Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Berkman, Nate Felstein, Augusta, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warner, Trina Nadura, Sam Alcofte, Marie Astugio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karen, and Hani Masood and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheh.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon Republicans walk out and stay out for a second day, preventing bills on gun control and reproductive freedom to move forward. Oregon and Washington are about to get millions of dollars worth of trees because of the president's Inflation Reduction Act. And young people in another state are suing due to climate change. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 4th, 2023. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. Russia claims the Kremlin came under attack by a Ukrainian drone. At the same time, Ukraine is worried that's just an excuse to ramp up Russian aggression. KBOO's Josh Salem has the latest on the situation.
Russia claims it foiled an attack by Ukrainian drones on the Kremlin yesterday. They claimed it was an unsuccessful assassination attempt against President Vladimir Putin and promised retaliation for what was termed a terrorist act. Ukraine's President Vladimir Zelensky denied the allegation, saying, quote, "We don't attack Putin or Moscow," end quote. Putin was actually at his residence outside Moscow at the time. There was no independent verification of the supposed attack, and in fact, Russia presented no evidence to support their claim. A video shot from across the river from the Kremlin appeared to show smoke rising over the buildings. Residents of a nearby apartment building reported hearing bangs and seeing smoke around 2:30 a.m. Another video on social media appeared to show a drone exploding above the roof of the Senate Palace in the Kremlin, with debris falling onto that roof. This footage also could not be independently verified. The Kremlin said Russian military forces stopped the drones before they could strike, and that nobody was hurt. Ukraine is worried the claims could provide a pretext for Russia to justify strikes on Ukrainian cities, the civilian population, or other infrastructure. The White House said the U.S. was unable to confirm the authenticity of Russia's claim. The United Nations said it, quote, "is not in a position to confirm these reports. We strongly reiterate our call on all concerned to refrain from any rhetoric or action that could further escalate the conflict," end quote. The purported drone attack, if true, would be a significant escalation in the war. It may have represented a warning shot by Ukraine, or could have been a false flag operation by Moscow designed to justify more intense attacks on Ukraine. The alleged attack prompted calls in Russia from pro-Kremlin figures for assassinations of senior leaders in Ukraine. The Kremlin claimed the attack was planned to disrupt Victory Day, which Russia celebrates in Red Square on May 9th to commemorate the defeat of Nazi Germany in World War II. In other news about the conflict, military analysts think Ukraine is targeting Russian supply lines while gearing up for a possible counteroffensive amid improving weather and as it receives more weapons and ammunition from the West. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
For a second day in a row, Republican members of the Oregon Senate are staying home. They're denying Democrats who control the legislature the required quorum of at least 20 senators in order for work to continue. Though Republicans claim their response was due to bills not meeting requirements for being written in plain, understandable language, they are delaying action on bills they oppose about gun safety, abortion rights, and gender-affirming health care. If Republicans continue their walkout, they could be violating a new law that Oregonians passed last November, banning lawmakers who have 10 or more unexcused absences from running for re-election. Two-thirds of the state House and Senate members need to be in the chamber for work to progress in Oregon's legislature. The Inflation Reduction Act included $1.5 billion for the U.S. Forest Service's Urban and Community Forestry Program, including millions of dollars for Oregon and Washington. The money supports adding trees in cities with benefits for both the environment and human health. I talked to Dr. Vivek Shandis, a professor and the director of the Sustaining Urban Places Research Lab at Portland State University. Tell me, first of all, about you're actually professor and director of the Sustaining Urban Places Research Lab at PSU. Tell me about this lab.
The Sustaining Urban Places Research Lab is really an attempt to try to bring the science that's being done in the university out into the community. Often what happens is that we find that the work, the amazing work happening in universities often gets published in papers, or there's a small group of people who meet about it and talk about it, and really no mechanism to get that work out into the community. So all of the projects happening in what we call the super lab is really about trying to liberate knowledge in some ways, is to try to get the information out to the policy makers, to the community residents, to journalists, and really trying to establish a pathway that allows the work that we're doing to find real application out in the community. So that's at the kind of purpose of the lab. The kind of work we do focuses heavily on the intersection of kind of it built environment, that's like cities and kind of the way cities are built, what goes into those decisions about the building of our cities, issues around environmental health. So that's really how does the development of our cities directly impact our human health and well-being? And then the third component is really around community engagement. And I was mentioning that the idea of how we're really interested in wanting to make this work accessible to broader communities than necessarily just stuck in a university. So all of our projects are really about how do we talk to the stakeholders that are directly impacted by some of the decisions being made about, you know, this big post office that's suddenly going to show up in my neighborhood, or trees that are being removed across this particular part of the city, or trees that are being planted in this part of the city, or changes in air quality that we might be able to detect using some of our analytical tools and methods. And so we really are interested in kind of bringing together the built environment, issues of environmental health, and then community engagement.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And does it seem like a lot of your work is focused more in the Portland area or Oregon area, or is it really applicable across the country?
We tend to think about this work as kind of we test out a lot of things in the area that we live. So we want to kind of understand certain techniques, methods, whether it's around community engagement or environmental sensing, which we do a fair bit of here locally, because we have students, we have lots of kind of tools at our disposal. And then once we kind of really refine that, we've been taking it all over the country, all over the world, in fact. And so we've had projects that have occurred in Asia and Middle East. The website that you're looking at is admittedly a little dated. I've had a couple of graduate students help me with that website, but it's usually like a Sunday afternoon activity, which I haven't gotten to in a little while here. So students have often been the ones that have been working on that. And I haven't had a good student to update that website in a while, but our projects are really national in scope. And we've worked now in probably about 78 different cities around the country and about a dozen or so cities around the globe at this point. So it's pretty pretty far reaching at this point.
What are some of the projects that you've done and where have they been?
Yeah, so I think one of the highlight projects that I might bring up is a project that works with communities directly. So this is kind of the core of the project. It works with communities directly to go about and collect temperature and air quality measurements. And so a lot of communities don't know what air kind of quality air they're breathing. They don't know how hot it gets in their city and how that temperature varies from one part of one neighborhood to another neighborhood. So one of my favorite projects is we equip community members all over the place, all over the country and world, with these little research grade sensors. And they go out, put them on their bikes, put them on their cars, and they drive around. Some cases, they even walk around neighborhoods and their cities, and they collect hundreds of thousands of measurements. And then when we get those measurements back, we're able to do some fancy calculations with those measurements, and then serve back up to them what we find in very kind of visually compelling maps and descriptions, and even get to the point where we're able to describe why we might be seeing some of these patterns that we're noticing in different neighborhoods. And that's the aha moment for a lot of communities, because they're immediately saying, whoa, I didn't know that my friend's house is 20 degrees cooler than my house. And I know why every summer we hang out at her house, because it's so much more comfortable over there as opposed to my house. And this proves, and so there's a lot of these kinds of things that come up as we ask communities, like, what do you notice about these maps? Or what do you see happening here? And getting their lived experience into the kind of calculations that we make is really an enriching process for understanding what might be done as a result of these findings locally. And we've seen just so many projects kind of take off as a result of some of these analyses that we've done. That's definitely my favorite top of the list one that I tend to look at more often.
Well, we know some major money is coming towards urban forestry with the Inflation Reduction Act, including $1.5 billion for the U.S. Forest Service Urban and Community Forestry Program. We saw the first of that money get out to some of the states and territories in April, and the rest is coming in the coming months. What is this going to do in terms of helping adding trees to cities? And how can that help our environment and help our health too?
Yeah, so we've known for a very long time that the distribution of trees in our cities is really inequitable, meaning we have some neighborhoods that have the majority of trees and other neighborhoods that have little to no trees. And that's not by coincidence. And cities are planned very systematically and very intentionally. And so that is in large part due to historic planning and segregation policies that were in place for decades. And because of those planning policies, this particular tranche of funding that's coming from the feds right now is aiming to kind of right some of those wrongs that were originally created by federally based redlining policies and the like. Though now to right some of those wrongs is to say, hey, we really want to try to work with communities directly and try to find ways to bring green spaces into places where we haven't historically had green spaces in our U.S. cities. And that's really going to be playing out very differently in different communities. Each community is going to be facing different historical as well as built environment challenges. We know that's going to be something that everyone's going to have to wrangle with. And so how the money is going to be applied locally is going to vary, though I will say there's probably two to three things that are going to be very similar across the board. The first is that there's a big emphasis on what the feds call disadvantaged communities, and those are communities that have been marginalized. These are often Black, Brown, communities of color, tribal communities, those who are lower income communities that haven't had really much investment from the feds or locally on green space planning. And so this money will first and foremost really be targeting and focused on those communities that haven't had the benefit of having green spaces in and around their neighborhoods. The second is that we know that this is going to go to nonprofits, tribes, cities, municipalities, as well as universities. And the focus is on kind of shovel-ready projects. They're really emphasizing things where, you know, there's a schoolyard that has, for example, lots of asphalt. How do we bring greening into a schoolyard in a neighborhood? And that will really make a really big difference because we know that trees have a direct contribution to human health and well-being. And so those communities that receive a lot more green space now will be cooler from the hotter summers that we're getting. They'll be cooler. They'll be able to absorb more of the rainwater, will flood likely less. Their health, mental health, as well as their long-term generational health will improve as a result of this greening of spaces that are going to happen where people didn't and communities didn't really have trees in the past. So there's a lot of benefits that are going to play out eventually. And finally, I'll just note that this is an unprecedented moment for urban forestry, urban and community forestry, because we've never had, it's always been a very scrappy community doing a lot with a little. I've been in this field long enough to know that this kind of funding is often unheard of, and it'll really kind of, it's a game changer in many ways for what's going to happen in many places that haven't even thought about green space, and building capacity to be able to do green space planning is going to be really a transformational moment for many neighborhoods in the country.
Do you have any idea if any of this money is coming to Oregon or Washington yet?
Oregon and Washington State have been, at least the state foresters have received funding. I think Washington got somewhere around the lines of about $7 million. There's a table that has all this info, around $7 million. Oregon got about $3.5 million state money. And so the rest, the $1 billion, that was about $500 million. I think there's $1 billion that's now going to be kind of moved out through these different entities, nonprofits, tribes, universities, municipal entities generally. And I know California received something around $30 to $40 million as well.
Describe how much trees actually affect the heat and the air pollution in urban areas.
Yeah, so we know that trees are one of the three original air conditioning systems for humans, and the others being, of course, wind and water. Trees really play a role in reducing temperatures by upwards of 20 degrees Fahrenheit. We've documented plenty of evidence that really indicates, and that's primarily through shading. So we're shading these hard asphalt concrete surfaces that absorb the sun's radiation over time and retain it and then re-emit it. And that's that amplifies temperatures. And when you have shade there over a road or over a parking lot, that can really lower those temperatures considerably. In some cases, the difference between life and death, some have argued, is that level of reduction of temperatures from tree shade. The other is through evaporative transpiration, which is essentially the water being pulled up by the roots, being essentially evaporated out and out of the leaves, transpired out of the leaves. And as a result of that, we're actually cooling that surrounding environment through that transpiration process that trees are directly contributing to. And then with air pollution, particles in the air land directly on the leaves or the needles of trees, and that's kind of a deposition. It kind of scrubs the air. And the second is that trees pull up little bits of pollution, gas, mostly gases, through little holes in the bottom of the leaves called stomata. And so that also can reduce air pollutants in and around our neighborhoods.
Great information. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, Annette.
And that was my talk with Dr. Vivek Shandis, the director of the Sustaining Urban Places Research Lab at Portland State University. According to a new report, 85% of the pollutants causing health and economic harm are fossil fuel products. Now, as Alex Gonzalez reports, young people in Utah are the latest to sue their state for supporting the fossil fuel industry and claiming that's created the climate crisis.
Seven young adults are suing the state of Utah for alleging it's denied their state constitutional right to life and liberty by contributing to Utah's air pollution and climate crisis. 19-year-old Dallin Rima is one of the plaintiffs and has been involved with the case for about 2 years. He and other plaintiffs have received support from the legal nonprofit Our Children's Trust. He says he wanted to stand up for his life, health, and safety, which he says is under threat from state laws that call for Utah's government to maximize the development of fossil fuels.
I believe that we have a clear, very clear legal basis for our argument, and that I, along with my co-plaintiffs, are using the court system to protect our rights in the same way that other people use the courts every day for the same reason. It seems to me that the impacts of the climate crisis pose a very serious threat to the right to life.
Rima says it's been a rewarding experience and adds he's proud of the message he and the other plaintiffs are sending. Rima says last fall their case faced an unfavorable ruling in the district courts. Since then, they've appealed and the case has leapfrogged and is now headed to the state Supreme Court. Rima says they're expecting a hearing toward the end of this year. Air quality, drought, wildfire, and flooding are all concerns for Rima, which he says will have direct impacts on his health and those of other young Utahns. Rima and others are seeking climate action be taken by Utah's governor, executive departments, and various oversight boards. According to the plaintiff's complaint, under current greenhouse gas emission rates, children born in 2020 are expected to face more than a sevenfold increase in overall extreme climate events.
There's studies that have already shown that living in Utah your whole life can take one or more years off of your life just because of the poorness of the air quality, and that's sickening in its own way.
Rima says the courts are a great method to make your voice heard for those who aren't able to vote yet but are wanting to become engaged in the climate battle. Additionally, he encourages Utahns to get involved with local organizations and peacefully protest. I'm Alex Gonzalez.
Southern Californians are making efforts to capture rainwater, yet some still ends up in the ocean. Suzanne Potter reports experts are looking at ways to save more water.
Downtown LA has gotten 28 inches of rain this season, around double an average year, making it one of the top 10 wettest years on record. Streams typically drain into giant dams like the San Gabriel Dam, which was built in the 1930s. Sterling Klippel is principal stormwater engineer for the county. He says when reservoirs fill up, officials open the floodgates to send water to spreading grounds downstream.
The water then will percolate through this kind of sandy, gravelly geology here and recharge these local aquifers, where later it's pumped out for local municipal water use.
LA County gets about a third of its water from those aquifers, while the rest is imported either from Northern California or from the Colorado River. But the city of LA's goal is to flip that equation by 2035, using two-thirds local water and cutting Southern California's dependence on imported water. Bruce Resnick with the nonprofit LA Waterkeeper says the local infrastructure is just not set up for that yet.
So much of LA is channelized and concretized and urbanized that we're not letting Mother Nature do its job of capturing the stormwater, letting it recharge our groundwater. We are trying to undo a century worth of poor planning around water, and it's going to take us a while.
LA County voters passed Measure W 5 years ago. It devotes $280 million each year to water projects. But Professor Dan McCurry at USC thinks it'll take several billion dollars to hit that 2035 goal to use mostly local water. And he says capturing more stormwater is one of the best tools we've got.
We're not talking about complicated, energy-intensive, expensive engineering treatment processes like we have to do for wastewater reuse. So in some sense, stormwater capture when it's available is low-hanging fruit.
I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, cloudy with a slight chance of rain, a low down to 49. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy skies continue with occasional showers in the afternoon, the high reaching 56. Today in history, on this date in 1970, the Ohio National Guard shot and killed four unarmed Kent State University students and wounded nine others during an anti-Vietnam War demonstration. Our quote of the day is from Deborah Wiles. When the state silences freedom of assembly and freedom to dissent, it silences the people it is sworn to protect. The U.S. Surgeon General has announced that widespread loneliness poses health risks that are as deadly as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Dr. Vivek Murthy issued an 81-page report, which also says loneliness costs the healthcare industry billions of dollars every year. Murthy says he wants to pull back the curtain on a struggle that too many people are experiencing. About half of American adults say they've experienced loneliness. Voter registration hit a 20-year high in last year's midterms. Iowa Democrats work around losing their early caucus status, and Florida Republicans vote to shield their top lawmakers' travel records from the public. With more in the stories impacting our democracy, here's the latest edition of 2023 Talks.
Your vote is precious, almost sacred. It is the most powerful nonviolent tool we have to create a more perfect union.
The late Georgia Congressman John Lewis addressed the Democratic National Convention in 2012 about the suppression of voters' rights. New census data shows registration rates in the 2022 midterms were the highest in 20 years, with voting-age citizens registered to vote topping 69%. Nearly half voted early, in person, or by mail. The Federal Reserve has raised its key interest rate by a quarter point to the highest level in 16 years, and Chairman Jerome Powell says regulators have yet to decide if today's hike will be the last.
My colleagues and I understand the hardship that high inflation is causing, and we remain strongly committed to bringing inflation back down to our 2% goal.
Powell says it's essential Congress raise the nation's debt limit to avoid a default. Lawmakers have until June 1st to strike a deal. Iowa Democrats say they have a solution to losing their leadoff spot on the party's presidential nominating calendar. Hold the caucus, but withhold the results until other states report theirs. Iowa Democratic Chair Rita Hart says the plan shows Iowa's willingness to work with the DNC.
Iowa Democrats will do what's best for Iowa, and that means moving forward with the most inclusive caucus process in Iowa history.
The DNC voted earlier this year to replace Iowa with South Carolina as the first voting state for 2024. New Hampshire has signaled its intention to keep the state's first-in-the-nation primary, regardless of how the DNC restructures the voting calendar. The union representing more than 11,000 writers of film, television, and other entertainment are on their third day of a strike. Writer Sean Crespo tells the Associated Press the demands on writers have been building for years.
There's too much work and not enough pay. Like, there's not really a path to middle-class living anymore as a writer.
Artificial intelligence is also a concern. The last Hollywood writer's strike in 2008 took 3 months to resolve. Governor Ron DeSantis is expected to sign legislation this week to shield the travel records of the state's top leaders from public record laws. DeSantis says he did not propose the bill, but it is backed by law enforcement.
You know, some people can agree with that, some people are not, but I think it's motivated by a security concern.
Florida Democrats criticize the bill for also shielding disclosure of with whom state leaders are meeting and why. A bill in Texas would allow the Secretary of State to overturn the results of an election in the state's largest county and order a new one. The bill targets Democratic-leaning Harris County, which includes Houston, and could force a new election if at least 2% of polling stations run out of ballot paper for more than an hour. I'm Catherine Carleaf.
Trauma care is at the center of the National Tribal Health Conference in Alaska. A Native broadcast summit celebrates 50 years of mass communicating. And Health and Human Services doubles a program for babies in low-income families. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
Indigenous culture and traditions are naturally therapeutic. That's the message at the National Tribal Health Conference in Anchorage, Alaska this week.
Not one tribe has the answers and the secrets to healing.
Julie Smith Ulanimi teaches at the University of North Dakota's Indigenous Health Department. She believes sharing traditional knowledge can help bring about a collective healing to address the intergenerational trauma that has affected several generations of Native Americans. Raquel Britton from the Round Valley Indian Tribe Youth Council in California came in search of answers. She says intergenerational trauma is something families do not like to talk about.
My family went through historical trauma that we're finally just breaking the cycle that my mother went through it with her mother.
Britton says her mother has just now started to talk with her children about the family's history of trauma and wants to know what she can do to heal her own struggles and help others. Smith Ulanimi says she turns to trusted elders for advice. A source of wisdom can be surprisingly close at hand, as it was when she visited an elder battling cancer. She found the woman in her hospital bed doing beadwork and has never forgotten her words.
When you're in pain or if you're sick, help create joy in somebody else. So she sat and beaded for hours and hours and hours and hours and brought me joy.
She shared what brought her joy at the conference as she passed around an elaborate beaded collar the elder gifted her. She says the woman survived cancer and is still alive today. Native American and Alaska Native media professionals are celebrating 50 years of broadcasting in Indian country. Tribal radio and television stations gathered in Phoenix, Arizona Wednesday for a Native broadcast summit. Loris Taylor is president and CEO of Native Public Media.
Radio and television are such powerful mediums, and I see them as almost akin to a drum in the plaza where we're beating that drum, right? It's also this invisible through line that is tethered to our language, our cultural practices, our identity. They speak to the agency we have to tell our own stories.
Tribal media is an important part of Native communities across the country for news, entertainment, and emergency messaging. George Strong is the general manager of KBFT Radio in Netlake, Minnesota.
We get to tell the story from our perspective. It's something that allows us to share our knowledge, our culture, our language. And I look at it more of a bridge-building, communicative, to kind of create a bridge between our local communities.
There are more than 60 tribal radio stations and 3 tribal TV stations in the NPM network. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services will double funding available for the nation's first ever diaper distribution program, and 2 tribal organizations will benefit. The program was launched last September. This week, the agency announced an additional $8.2 million, doubling funding for the program, which aims to serve low-income families nationwide. The Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate of South Dakota and the South Puget Intertribal Planning Agency in Washington State are participating. According to the agency, 1 in 3 families do not have enough diapers to meet the needs of their children. Low-income families are disproportionately affected and, in some cases, spend up to 8% of their income on diapers. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Scientists in the western U.S. are trying to solve a mystery why there are hundreds of thousands fewer mule deer now compared to how many there were in the 90s. As Eric Golatis reports, one factor might be competition from elk.
Thriving elk herds are adding to the challenges facing mule deer populations, which have been on the decline for decades in Wyoming and across the West, according to emerging research. Kevin Monteith, a natural resource science professor at the University of Wyoming, says when mule deer live closer to elk, it comes at a cost to their fat gain over summer. That's important because the amount of fat that female deer enter winter with plays a big role in their ability to survive and produce fawns in springtime.
When there's a fat deficit associated with exposure to elk, and that's subsequently going to have ramifications associated with overwinter survival for those deer because they're not gaining the fat that they would otherwise during the summer.
Mule deer tend to eat in isolation, and when they're forced to compete for forage areas, they are easily bumped away by much larger elk who dine in groups. The number of mule deer in Wyoming has dropped from 578,000 in 1991 to just 300,000 today. Last year, the Wyoming Game and Fish Department launched a 5-year mule deer monitoring project to determine